full program today for you. Good afternoon, and thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. My name is Amy Liu, and I am the Deputy Director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'd like to welcome you today to a forum to discuss a bold and promising idea about how to strengthen our nation's capacity to move toward a strong alternative energy future. Now, today's topic could not be more timely. We are in the midst of an economic downturn with some very fervent debates here in Washington about how to stimulate short-term job growth while at the same time laying the foundation for a 21st century economy. At the heart of that 21st century economy is the desire to build a green economy and that will help us move towards energy independence. Now, our interest at Brookings in this moment is primarily twofold and is based on an initiative we launched almost over a year ago called A Blueprint for American Prosperity, which aims to offer to Congress and the new administration a series of practical ideas to modernize bottoms-up approaches to economic prosperity. First, as the Metropolitan Policy Program, we want to remind our national leaders that our economy is inherently metropolitan. As competitiveness guru Michael Porter recently argued, there is no U.S. economy. There's just a network of hyperlinked, hyperintegrated metropolitan economies. In fact, the largest 100 metropolitan areas alone generate 75% of the nation's GDP. So our mantra has been, even in this economic recovery package debate, that let's focus our investments, let's focus and stimulate smart approaches where the economy is. Second, metropolitan areas are our economic engines because the public and private sector leaders in them wake up every day leveraging the very assets that drive productivity and economic prosperity. Those assets are innovation, infrastructure, human capital, and building high-quality places to live and work. This idea, then, to create an Energy Discovery Innovation Institute embodies the real-time way that one of these assets, energy innovation, will be deployed. The reality is that we will need a network of universities, of federal labs, industry, venture capitalists, workforce developers, and others working together, albeit sometimes in little messy ways, but working together to create and commercialize alternative sources of energy for the nation. So if done right, this concept that we're going to talk about today will yield a three-pronged prosperity: high productivity, energy and environmental sustainability, and an inclusive economy that engages and expands the skills and opportunities of our workers. Which brings us to today. We have an exciting program planned, filled with a number of top-notch speakers and presenters. We are very fortunate and honored to have three universities' presidents present and discuss the proposal to create the shorthand of EDIIs. And the universities are an important part of this equation because they are not only the anchor institutions, but very, very much the foundation for learning, innovation, and workforce development in our urban and metropolitan economies. So to start, we will hear from Jim Duderstadt, the emeritus president of the University of Michigan and a longtime professor and expert on science, engineering, and technology. And I just want to say a brief words about Dr. Duderstadt. The notion of how to generate energy alternatives did not germinate here in Washington, D.C., but really outside the Beltway, and which is how we do the bulk of our work, is really learning from practice on the ground. We learned that Jim was working to make his own university a hub of energy research and potentially being a model for other universities in the important Great Lakes region. So we began to consider whether there wasn't something of wider national value useful to multiple cities and locations and for the nation as a whole. And Jim agreed to partner with us, and we then enlisted the chairs for this R&D efforts with Dr. Gordon Gee and Dr. and Michael Crow, the presidents of The Ohio State University and Arizona State University, two of the leading university presidents and innovation champions in America. Now, to hatch the paper and this concept with them was a really stellar coterie of science, energy, climate, engineering, and research experts that became the Next Energy Working Group behind this effort. So this afternoon, you will hear from Dr. Duderstadt, who will present this policy idea. Drs. Gee and Crow will then comment on this new paper we are releasing today. Now, following their discussion, we will hear from Senator Sherrod Brown, who has been working to build an alternative energy industry in Ohio. And then after some questions from you in the audience, and we do want to leave some time for that, we will hear then a variety of reactions to the proposal from leaders in the field who will be very much affected and partners to this dynamic concept, someone who represents environmental thought, the venture capital community, the private sector, and regional economic development. And this discussion will be moderated by our good friend Bill Bates from the Council on Competitiveness. Now, before we get started, I do want to thank a few people who have made extraordinary contributions to this work. Again, we wouldn't be able to announce and form this very wonderful idea if it were not for a large group of partners in this effort. First and foremost, we want to thank Jim Duderstadt and the entire Next Energy team for their ideas and labors this year, as well as a number of people whose guidance and insights were consistently helpful, including Joe Checkey of University of New Mexico, Don Lamb of University of Chicago, Nate Lewis of Caltech, Terry Mikulski at Sandia National Lab, David Pines of University of Illinois. Again, all of these are prominent leaders and thinkers in the field in their own right. Brad Whitehead at the Fund for Our Economic Future in Northeast Ohio, and then finally Nancy Zimfer, President of University of Cincinnati and the head of the Coalition of Urban Serving Universities. Again, we very much value your engagement thus far. Finally, I do want to give our deepest gratitude to Mark Miro, who's the fellow and the policy director here at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program and also a co-author of this report. You will meet him in a few minutes because he's going to step up here and help facilitate today. But I think all of us who've been working through this project really want to thank him and his policy team for really being not only an intellectual innovator in this project, but really managing this concept from inception to now. So without further ado, I now want to have us kick off this afternoon with a very dynamic force of energy himself, and that is Keith Cooley, who is the CEO of Next Energy. Next Energy is a nonprofit corporation in Michigan that's dedicated to developing alternative energy technologies through technology collaborations, smart energy policy, and incubating support for new business ventures. Now, prior to joining Next Energy, Cooley was the director of the Department of Labor and Economic Growth for the state of Michigan under Governor Granholm. And for many of us who care about workforce innovations, we especially appreciate his time as CEO of Focus Hope, a national model of manufacturing-based workforce development serving underrepresented urban youth. So please join me in welcoming Keith Cooley.
Good afternoon to all of you. As Amy mentioned, I am Keith Cooley, president of Next Energy, a different Next Energy than the team you have here, certainly, but have to offer my thanks for allowing me to be part of this august group. As Amy pointed out, Next Energy in Michigan is doing a lot of really neat things that I think fit well with this meeting. We facilitate research and development through strategic public, university, and private consortia. We connect ventures and emerging technologies to key strategic partners, including potential markets, supply chains, and investors, and help companies break into new markets through a perfect fit of auto suppliers in our area and wind turbine manufacturers to support a wind industry growth in the Midwest markets. So in some ways, What we do represents a microcosm of the key points in today's presentations: the promise of innovation, the challenge of commercialization, and the power of collaboration. Because the pathway we've used in Michigan builds strategic partnerships that draw on the strengths of the universities, the federal agencies, the labs, and industry. But our discussion today is about more than a small organization building alternative energy assets in the Midwest. It's about America, because energy drives America. This isn't any news to any of you here, but I want to remind us of the backdrop against which this wonderful discussion will take place. Cheap, accessible energy is so integrated into our lives that it is a fundamental American expectation. We need it for transportation, manufacturing, business, homes, and offices. It fuels our economy and our lifestyles. The problem is, the demand is growing, the supply is shrinking. U.S. energy consumption alone has more than doubled since the 1960s and continues to head north. China is now number two behind the United States for consumption. 10 years ago, they weren't in the top 10. So the results are predictable. Energy prices are rising, national security is weakened, the environment, of course, has been threatened, so it's clear why we are all here today. Now is the time for finding alternatives and making them work, not just as proofs of concept, not just as technologies in the lab, but in the broader landscape of the American energy industry, the transportation sector, our national infrastructure, our businesses, and our environmental values, and as a continuing driver of our economy as a whole. That won't be easy, because on many fronts in this country, a sense of urgency around this issue doesn't exist. You here have a different sense. You've looked around. You know that clearly we ain't in Kansas anymore. International competition is worrisome. Our power grid is aging. I've learned that in some places the grid is 100 years old or more. The hidden costs of oil and coal are an increasing burden, and the current state of the economy is untenable. Across the nation, unemployment is now about 7.1%. It hasn't been that high in 26 years. And in Michigan, where I'm from, 10.6%. We lead the nation. We can't live that way anymore. There's an old saying we have, maybe you have it too. It goes this way. When everything is coming your way, you're in the wrong lane. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Alternative energy isn't the answer to everything, but it's a key piece of the puzzle if the United States is going to continue to lead. And innovation in that space is crucial to our survival. Point of interest for you. As we talked earlier, we're having good success on a much smaller scale in Michigan with Next Energy, with collaboration. We have something we call the State Centers of Energy Excellence, built around specific technologies, new tech companies, universities, the Department of Energy, our utilities, and others. They built a concentrated value chain for success. Gasification, biomatter, bioenergy, waste-to-energy initiatives are collaborative projects with the universities, DOD, DOE, and others. That's what's moving us forward. That's what's working. So, what would happen if we in this room pledged, as we left, to take the best of what DOE and the other federal agencies have to offer, the best of what the universities do, the best of what industry does, and bring them together with a real sense of urgency and a real focus? That's how we as a nation have to move forward. We don't have the time, the money, or the resources for business as usual. Now, I don't mean to suggest that this is simple. The energy industry is a complex system. Multinational companies, government regulations, varying state mandates, incentives and subsidies, value chain interdependencies, and feedback loops that would drive you crazy. Trust me, being working in government, I know for a fact. But we are in the wrong lane. We're in the wrong lane right now, and we know it. So our challenge is to find a model that works on a national scale. And that's a perfect opportunity to give the floor to a very good friend of mine, Jim Duderstadt, and his colleagues, Presidents Gordon Gee and President Michael Crow. They have an intriguing option for us to consider. So President Duderstadt, the mic is yours.
If you drill down deep enough into Keith Cooley's past, back beyond his current role at Next Energy, Michigan State Government, Focus Hope, go back through General Motors and Cadillac, General Electric, You'll find him in the early 1970s as a graduate student in nuclear engineering, where I was a young wet behind the engineer assistant professor. So we do go back a long ways. And I apologize for stealing the next energy title to refer to our team. I should point out that that team not only consisted of a number of faculty, scientists, engineers, and others from universities in the Midwestern United States and the Mountain West and in the West, but as well colleagues from other universities around the country, from the national laboratories, from industry, and most recently with members of the transition team that were considering innovation and energy policies for the new administration. Leading this effort is a little bit like herding cats, but with each revision, I think the whole effort got a bit stronger. Let's see. That's me. Let me begin with a punchline. Our report consists really of two primary recommendations. The first is to recommend a very significant increase in federal energy R&D, which despite the increasing urgency of the need for new energy technologies, has actually declined over the last two decades and remains frozen at about one-fifth of that of the level of the early 1980s. Furthermore, the energy industry itself, for a variety of reasons we'll go into later, has one of the lowest levels of R&D among the nation's economic sectors. So the first major recommendation is we've simply got to step forward and pump up that investment, most of which will go into existing resources like the federal laboratories and into industry. But in addition to the critical efforts of the labs and industry, new research paradigms are necessary, we believe, that better leverage the unique capacity of America's research universities to span the complex array of issues that characterize our energy challenges, not simply science and technological, but economic, social, behavioral, and policy issues. And furthermore, to produce the human resources, the scientists, the engineers, the managers, we're going to have to build and then maintain this new energy infrastructure for the nation. America's challenge, well, in a sense here, I'm really speaking to the choir. America faces an interrelated set of very broad energy challenges. Supply, security, and environmental challenges, which plague world's energy production. It's going to require transformative innovation to commercialize and deploy new energy breakthroughs. And multiple market and government failures are going to have to be overcome that today hinder energy innovation and problem solving. Everyone here, I think, knows this, but let me kind of remind you of what some of the issues are. If you look at the projected growth in energy demand around the world over the next couple of decades, you'll see most of that growth is occurring in developing economies, soon projected to swamp those of the developed world. This rapid growth is likely to create a permanent imbalance between energy supply and demand, causing frequent price spiking and havoc with energy markets. Second, despite rhetoric to the contrary, federal inaction and inadequate policies has left us becoming ever more dependent on imported petroleum. Here you see that we're rapidly approaching the situation where we're importing 70% of the oil used by this country. The environmental challenge. Well, here I have to speak as a scientist, and I have to join my colleagues, which represent the vast majority of the scientific community, in stating my belief that global climate change driven by fossil fuels is not only real, but to quote John Holdren, the most serious environmental challenge that will be faced by our civilization. We simply must develop and deploy alternative energy technologies, and we must do it soon. The technology challenge. Current energy technologies, although promising, have not yet achieved both the scale and the cost structures necessary for commercialization. There are a couple of reasons for this. They have to do with market failures in part. Current energy prices do not internalize all of the costs, for example, the cost of carbon emissions. Furthermore, as I mentioned earlier, the energy industry seriously underinvests in R&D. But on the other hand, this is in part because of the long timeline that's required for developing, commercializing, and deploying energy technologies, which is incompatible with the very short quarter-by-quarter focus of investors on P&L statements. Finally, the complexity challenge. Large-scale deployment of sustainable energy technologies involve not only advanced scientific research and development of new technologies, but they also involve a very complex array of other issues: social, economic, legal, political, behavioral, consumer, and market issues. And they're all characterized by complex interrelationships at the regional, the national, and the international level. Existing federal policy simply is not adequate to deal with these complexities. This involves both the magnitude of current energy, of current U.S. energy research, as well as the character and format of the U.S. energy research itself. Let me go into these in just a little bit of detail. It's striking to note how much the decline in federal R&D and in industrial R&D in energy has occurred over the last three decades since the shock of the OPEC oil embargo. Federal energy R&D, despite the increasing urgency, has declined to a level only one-fifth of that of the 1980s. As I mentioned earlier, the energy industry itself has one of the lowest levels of investment in R&D. And in fact, high-tech industries such as electronics and pharmaceuticals spend now over 10 times as much of their revenues relatively on research as does the energy industry. Hence, our proposal is to call on the federal government to increase its investment in energy R&D to levels comparable to that of other national priorities, such as healthcare, space exploration, and national defense, which would take it to a level somewhere in the range of $25 to $30 billion a year. The second recommendation, The second recommendation has to do with the character and the format of the U.S. energy research activity itself. The national laboratories and corporate R&D activities have critical resources and capability, and there is no question that they're deserving of much stronger support. But we believe that they need to be augmented to address the full complexity of the energy challenge, which involves more, as I said, than science and technology. It extends to business issues, innovation, commercialization, and deployment, to social and behavioral issues, getting people to conserve energy, to invest upfront in energy-efficient technologies. Furthermore, unlike biomedical research and defense research, federal energy research activities have failed to adequately engage the third leg of the triad of the American research enterprise, which, of course, are the nation's research universities, which not only have broader intellectual span, but furthermore are the key to producing the human resources, as I say, the scientists, the engineers, and others capable of building and maintaining the energy infrastructure this country is going to have to achieve. So we're suggesting a new federal approach. These are the two bullets that I gave you earlier, to increase energy R&D by at least an order of magnitude, and then to augment the existing activities with new kinds of research paradigms. Let me go into each quite briefly. We suggest that federal investment in energy R&D should grow to between $20 to $30 billion a year annually. You can get at this number in a variety of ways, looking at the size of the energy sector of our economy, at the size of federal investments in other national priorities of comparable importance, healthcare, space exploration, national defense, and so forth. Most of the growth, we believe, would flow to the existing major players, the nation's research community, the federal laboratories, particularly those of the DOE laboratories, and to industry. But these represent only two-thirds of the national research enterprise. As I said, the complexity and scale of the nation's energy challenges demand that we engage the third leg, America's research universities. Today, these have not been key players in energy R&D, that they are in other national priorities such as healthcare, agriculture, and national defense. To this point, what we're doing is we're suggesting one of many possible paradigms, but one that's particularly interesting. These are called Discovery Innovation Institutes. They were an idea that spun out of the early effort that led to the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report of the national academies. These are research centers, rather significant in size, that are designed to couple fundamental scientific discovery with use-inspired R&D that will add the technological innovation leading to new products and processes. You might think of these as the kind of research that was done years ago at places like Bell Labs, until it was eliminated essentially by very strong shareholder pressure focused on quarterly earnings statements. But there's another wrinkle in all of this. The Brookings Energy team has expanded the concept somewhat by drawing on the highly successful examples of the land-grant programs of the late 19th and 20th centuries, which in many ways were responsible for the modernization of American agriculture and industry, establishing our nation during the 20th century as not only the breadbasket for the world, but the economic engine of our society. By creating agricultural and engineering experiment stations and their associated extension services, the land-grant universities were able to couple use-inspired research and technological innovation with commercial markets. They worked hand-in-hand with farmers and small business. They aligned national priorities with a powerful mechanism for stimulating regional economic development. This network today of land-grant models continues as a highly successful paradigm for technology development, commercialization, and deployment in the marketplace. It's done so for over a century, and we believe that this model can and should be applied to address the nation's energy challenges. In fact, we suggest that the pervasive character of the energy challenge is more similar to that of building a modern agricultural industrial society than it is of landing a man on the moon or building the first atomic bomb. Rather, our proposal is to create a national network of energy discovery innovation institutes associated with the nation's research universities and national laboratories that is, in fact, an effort to apply the highly successful 20th century land-grant models to address the 21st century challenge of building a sustainable energy infrastructure. The Energy Discovery Innovation Institutes would combine the best qualities of a number of paradigms. Like agricultural experiment stations, they would be responsive to social priorities with regional impact. Like academic medical centers, they would link research, education, and practice. And like corporate R&D labs, they would link discoveries with the applied research necessary to produce innovative products, but would also educate the next generation of high-tech workers. Now, our proposal suggests that there'd be quite a broad diversity of these institutes, both in scale and in character. Some would be associated with universities, some with federal laboratories, still others with partnerships of universities and national laboratories. Some would address specific technologies, renewable energy, biofuels, nuclear energy, carbon sequestration. Others would address social issues, such as conservation, mass transportation, and behavioral change. Some could address unusual regional challenges, such as the energy-intensive nature of the economy in the Great Lakes area or the fragile environmental conditions characterizing the Mountain West. We see core federal support for these also over a diverse range, from smaller institutes, typically associated with a single university or laboratory, that might be funded at the level of tens of millions of dollars, to perhaps very large institutes at the perhaps $200 million level that would be operated by consortia of universities, by major national laboratories, or by partnerships between national laboratories and universities. Total federal commitments for several dozen of these would build to roughly 20% of the growth we're proposing in federal investment in energy R&D, approaching $6 billion a year. It would be augmented by support from the states, for example, that might provide land or capital facilities, by industry, by investors, and by universities themselves. Now, there are a great many other issues involved in how you put together a program like this. We think the reward process should be evaluated on an interagency basis, involve strong peer review, might be led by an organization like NSF in terms of the competition itself, which has had experience with launching a series of major research centers across the country. The award criterion would certainly include scientific merit, capability, but also strength of the management plan, commercialization, integration into the regional economy, and it would require continued evaluation of the effectiveness of that. There's also a suggestion that's been provided to us by a number of eminent scientists that would link together existing and perhaps future fundamental research, both on the campuses and elsewhere, in essentially a hub and spoke kind of a network. We think that because of the size of this, it would be appropriate to phase it in, perhaps creating a competition for half a dozen such institutes a year. It would require a tiered organization. These are partnerships, okay, so that it will involve some kind of a management structure with executive authority, not only involving the labs and the universities, but participating industrial partners, perhaps entrepreneurs, investment community, state, federal government as well. linked external relationships. Today, we can build these in a way you couldn't have done in the land-grant era using powerful cyber infrastructure to coordinate these activities. In fact, you might even imagine these as virtual organizations in some cases, which do not have a physical location but link together a large number of institutions across the nation. Finally, we see these established, managed, and funded as an interagency effort on the part of the federal government. But it's important to have a lead agency, and that would, likely be the Department of Energy. Where would the funding come from? It might come from the diversion of existing energy-related subsidies. Over the last 30 to 40 years, the nation has invested almost $500 billion in energy, some of it in R&D, much of it in other kinds of support. It might come from general revenue, or it might come from the appearance of a carbon tax or cap-and-trade scheme. But in the end, we believe that the need to reinvigorate America's economy and place it on a more sustainable footing compels the transformation of U.S. energy policy. Quite frankly, the sheer scale and complexity of the nation's energy challenges requires not only a greatly enhanced federal investment in energy R&D, comparable in magnitude to the R&D addressing other national priorities, it also requires new approaches that extend and complement the very considerable capabilities of our national laboratories and industries with the assets of the nation's research universities. The creation of a national network of regionally based energy discovery innovation institutes also represents a very worthy successor to the visionary modernization of American agriculture and industry undertaken by the land-grant acts of the 19th century. The time has come for America to innovate, and the earlier land-grant acts appear to provide an appropriate model. It's time as well to increase federal investment in energy R&D to levels commensurate with efforts to address other major national priorities. To augment the very considerable capability of the nation's federal and industrial research laboratories with this proposed network of energy discovery innovation institutes would catalyze a new partnership of research universities, federal laboratories, business and industry, entrepreneurs and investors, federal, state, and local government to stimulate strong regional economic growth while inventing and building a sustainable national energy infrastructure for the 21st century. So with that as kind of a summary of what the report is proposing, let me now turn to the introduction of the two co-chairs of this effort, Presidents Gordon Gee and Michael Crow. Both are regarded as among the most visionary, energetic and effective leaders in higher education. Both come from states with great energy assets, but also considerable energy challenges. Both come from institutions that have beaten mine at the University of Michigan in football, but only very rarely during my watch as university president. President Gee.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank the Brookings Institute for inviting me to be part of this report's development, and I also want to acknowledge that despite Jim Duderstadt's connection to the University of Michigan, he really did a brilliant job. I will also note that during my first tenure at Ohio State, our football team has won 5-1 against Michigan. That was the reason I had to leave. Then Jim stepped down, and now, of course, we've fared better. So I'm grateful to be here today with Senator Brown here and myself and Jeff Wadsworth from Battelle. It might seem like we have an Ohio cabal. I assure you we do not, though I'm honored, as always, to work in partnership with them. In fact, the creation of this report was also a true collaboration. I firmly believe in this effort, in combining thoughtful, creative people who care deeply about these issues, and I believe that this is the only path toward their resolution. Now, we have heard this a lot over the past weeks and months, but let me say this again. Moments that are particularly vexing are also moments ripe for revolution. We have now a groundswell of agreement. America's utter dependence on fossil fuels weakens us in very critical ways. As supplies dwindle and our environment suffers potentially irreversible damage, we cannot sit idly by. It is inconceivable, and Jim just made this fact, and I just wanted to emphasize this again to all of you, it is inconceivable that federal funding for energy is now merely a fraction of what it was some 25 years ago. Now, I would ask the question, is additional funding required? Well, of course. But more importantly, we must form a new intellectual infrastructure, one with urgency of purpose and agility of unified action. There is much promising work at my own institution at Ohio State, and there is much at Arizona State and Michigan and Iowa and Washington State and so many of our colleges and universities and, of course, in our great national laboratories. But too much is occurring in isolation, and this is the result and the focus of this report. Silo thinking will not pull us out of this crisis. We must partner aggressively, and we must partner strategically. We must capitalize on areas of mutual interest and greatest potential. Regional partnerships, those proposed in this report make absolute sense. I'm especially pleased that Ohio State's neighbor, Jeff Wadsworth from Battelle, is part of today's panel and is part of this thinking and special effort. We are both fully committed to deepening our institution's partnerships for the public good economically and environmentally, socially, and in so many other ways. And I am fully determined that we will help reinvigorate our region's Rust Belt towns with green-collar jobs. American universities must apply our enormous resources to leading this new industrial revolution. We must be nimble and responsive, and we must be open and accountable. We all share a moral imperative to cast off old habits and heart and mind. We must believe and we must act in common purpose. And we must move with unparalleled ambition and deliberate speed. Simply put, our pace must hasten or our nation will sputter to a halt. Truly, the stakes of this crisis are much bigger than even a Sputnik moment. At issue is nothing less than our safety and security and our health and well-being. At issue, and this people are saying this all the time, but I believe this firmly, at issue is our nation's future. It is time for each and every one of us to roll up our sleeves, seek common ground, and intensify our work. It is, simply put, ladies and gentlemen, it is now time to act. This issue is far too important to allow it to languish any longer. So I thank you for letting me be part of this project, and I now turn over to my friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Crow. Michael.
Thank you, Gordon, and thank you, Jim, for your leadership, and Mark and Brookings Institution for their leadership in all of this. I think I'd like to take an angle of view in this discussion that asks each of you to think about why it is that we could find $25 billion if we took just the first part of this equation, put it in from a government expenditure perspective into the existing intellectual infrastructure that we have, and we would almost certainly fail if we didn't do anything else. We could find all the money that we could possibly print, which is what we do with money these days, and pour it into this problem, and it wouldn't actually allow us to organize ourselves to move in the right direction. We would take the existing infrastructure, and we would fail. So we need a change of mindset, and this report and this proposal outlines how this mindset can be shifted. Let me pick five particular points. The first thing that we have to start doing is stop measuring our scientific success by the amount of money we spend on science. We need to start thinking about and focusing on what is the outcome that we actually hope to achieve, regardless of what the outcome costs. So, for instance, if we're worried about our energy security, and if we're worried about our national security, if we're worried about our national sustainability, both economically and environmentally, let's set that as the objective. Let's measure every dollar that we spend toward that objective. Have we moved toward that objective? Not have we produced more scientific papers. We have to do that to get to the objective. Have we attained movement toward that objective? So that's the first point of changing mindset. We've got to start focusing on outcomes, not on inputs, because it's not about inputs. It's actually time to grow up. Second, we need increased cooperation between sectors. We just can't pull it off. Let me use an example of a project that we're managing at ASU right now. $100 million from the Army. The Army came in and said, there's a whole series of unknown scientific things that need to be worked out, a whole bunch of things that need to be thought through about how to produce a particular technology that the Army wants, a flexible display technology that a soldier can wear on their uniform to get information in real time. They said, we don't know what all the problems are. We don't even care what all the problems are. Don't even tell us what all the problems are. Just figure out how to make it. It's a completely different logic. So right now in one of our facilities are 30 companies, the Army, the university, and everybody else that you can possibly imagine focused on a cooperative venture, not to parse out who does the science and who does the technology and who does this part and who does that part. There's one objective: produce this technology and deploy it. It's a very different way of thinking about things, a very different way of approaching things. You have a solution and a mindset that you work toward. Third point: the linkage between research and development and entrepreneurial venture engagement needs to be shortened and greatly enhanced. I used to be the executive vice provost of Columbia University for more than 10 years, and we ran a technology transfer operation there. And this is not to criticize the Department of Energy, which I admire greatly, but that single university produced more technology transfer outcomes than all of the Department of Energy laboratories combined. Not because the Department of Energy laboratories weren't fantastic scientific institutions, but because the notion of instantaneous, doesn't exist in the lexicon of operating a government laboratory. It can't, for lots of reasons. And so how do we then design these linkages between research and development and entrepreneurial and venture activities so that in the United States we can take advantage of two powerful forces that we have: the force of entrepreneurism and the force of discovery, bringing those together to actually match up into this term that we're using for these institutes called innovation, instantaneous technology transfer. Fourth, we need new institutional structures that permit high-speed engagement around small-scale solutions. I think, Jim, you mentioned that this isn't going to be like the Manhattan Project or the Apollo Project, which were projects designed to produce a technological outcome with a single purpose that ultimately, while it had some side benefits to the economy, is very different than everything that we're talking about relative to energy. I think Jim says it right, and the report says it right. It's more like agriculture. It's more like other things. We need to find ways to build institutional structures that permit high-speed engagement across small-scale solutions, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, not single pathways. And then lastly, we need a regional network approach, which these institutes really outline for us and are really critically important to us. And let me use another example from Arizona. We've been struggling, and I've been struggling in the 7 years that I've been there. Why is it that, you know, we don't have just like the solar everything that you can possibly imagine in Arizona? Because it's very difficult. It's very difficult to take all the forces of an economy, all the forces of innovation, all the things that are working, each company's little direction and so forth, to actually build a plan, build a strategy, and so forth. So we've been working, for instance, in the last few months in Arizona to build a conceptual plan for a 20 gigawatt solar electric distribution system. I mean, everybody's at the table, all the solar companies, the universities, everybody, the power companies, the California power companies, the Arizona power companies, everybody. It is extremely difficult. And the existing structures that are in place, the existing mechanisms that are in place, the existing ways in which we integrate or don't integrate, mostly, research with other kinds of things, are actually the principal barriers that we have to success in building that 20 gigawatt solar electric distribution system in and around Arizona and Southern California. So the most important message I hope that you get from this presentation of this new concept for this institute is we have to change our mindset seriously. It's not about the money. It's about how we organize ourselves and how we move forward. Thank you.
Well, Jim, Dr. Gee, Dr. Kroll, thank you for those highly valuable perspectives. And with Jim's presentation, the President's reflections, I think you have framed our discussions quite well today, and we're going to continue doing that now. I also just wanted to acknowledge Congressman Gary Peters from the 9th District of Michigan, who is here, and perhaps we'll join the conversations later. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mark Murrow, fellow and policy director at the Metropolitan Program at Brookings, and as well as the manager of this project. And it's my great privilege now to usher our conversation on today by introducing Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who's going to provide some initial comments here. Few, I would say, are really better placed to do that. For three decades, Senator Brown has been a tireless advocate for job creation and working families all across Ohio. As a U.S. Senator, he's combined his dedication to rebuilding our nation's middle class and his commitment to protecting our environment with work to turn Ohio into what he calls a Silicon Valley of alternative energy. In the last 2 years, he's held more than 125 roundtables in all of Ohio's 88 counties. That's a lot of advance work for somebody there, and is but pulling together local business leaders, academics, workers, community leaders, and to talk over how to rebuild the economy and put Ohio and the nation on a course for energy sustainability. As a result of those roundtables, he introduced the Green Energy Production Act of 2008, which he has recently reintroduced. And the legislation would provide grants to encourage sustainable energy manufacturing technologies. More broadly, and I think provocatively, Senator Brown has emerged as an important member of what's being called the Tech 15 group of senators, who is going to play an inordinate role in any climate legislation in the coming session. Here as elsewhere, Senator Brown is focused intently on combining cost containment on carbon pricing with aggressive investment in new technologies. So Senator Brown is an important person to hear from today. So let's all welcome Senator Sherrod Brown.
You saw that perspective. Mark, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. President Dudenstadt, nice to see you, and President Crow, and Gordon Gee, my longtime friend from Ohio, Jeff Wadsworth, whom you'll hear from later, and the work that Battelle and Ohio State, the synergism coming out of there is a big part of the future, not just Central Ohio, but energy answers and other answers, and thanks for the work, the leadership you're showing in the national labs and the work that you're doing at Ohio State. When I came in, Dr. Gee was particularly nice to me. My mother passed away a week ago today, and he was very kind when I walked in, and I wanted to tell a real quick story about my mom. My mom was 88 years old, and she was doing very, very well, very active until the middle of December, and then got sick, and but she was very lucid and talked to us right up until the last two or three days. And we would, my brothers and I and my wife would spend most of every day, most days with her in these last 6 weeks at our home in Mansfield, about halfway between the cities of Cleveland and Columbus. And my mom was devout. She would like us to read from the Bible. I'd read from Psalms or read the Beatitudes to her, whatever. And she also, one day she asked me if I would sing a couple of Lutheran hymns to her. And I got my Lutheran, I found the old Lutheran hymn book on her shelf, the one from when I was a kid. And I began to sing Beautiful Savior, a song she loved. And she smiled as she was listening. This is about 4 or 5 days before she died. And then after I finished, she said, "That was very nice, but, you know, you sound better in a group." So she never really lost her ability to always say what she needed to say. Special thanks, too, to Bruce Katz at Brookings. Amy, thank you, and Mark, thank you for what you're doing with all of this. And Bruce has been particularly helpful in thinking about solutions in a state that's facing a lot of challenges. This country has been in recession for a year. My state and your state have been in recessions longer than that, as we know, and deeper recessions. And the work that Bruce has done to help Ohio figure out how to revitalize our metropolitan areas is really, really important, and we're so thankful for that. We're here, obviously, today to discuss a new era in green energy research and innovation, and I appreciate particularly President Dudenstadt's comments about commercializing as we develop this, as we do this research, as we develop new ways. And this will be an era that draws upon America's greatest strengths of creativity and entrepreneurship. It's an environment. If you listen to the outline of the three college presidents, university presidents, it's an environmental strategy, it's a national security strategy, it's an economic strategy. I want to talk mostly about the economic strategy, taking on some things that Keith said about unemployment and all that are so important. The stakes, as we know in our country today, couldn't be higher. The opportunity couldn't be greater. And I'm one of those people that thinks that climate change is probably the greatest moral question of our generation. And it's an opportunity also, though, to grow our economy and do all the things that everyone talked about here. Unemployment is at its highest in 16 years. We lost 2.6 million jobs in 2008 alone. We're now losing jobs at the rate of 400,000 to 500,000 a month. In the unemployment rate, your statistics were about 3 days behind, because they're now 7.6% nationally, I believe. And if you look at the underemployment, because a large number of Americans are either not looking now and not in all the statistics or are underemployed, that number is really double that. It's as high as 14%. Obviously, the economic and environmental policies that we've pursued in the last few years simply aren't working. That's why what you do as scientists, as advocates, as university people, policy experts, is all the work you do is so crucial. By investing in green energy research and in policies that tackle climate change and reduce our dependence on foreign oil, we can put our nation on the path for renewed economic success. It's not just an environmental issue, as you know. It's not just an energy issue. It really is about American jobs and rebuilding this economy. We can build we have a rare opportunity to reinvigorate manufacturing, which is not just a Midwest issue, although many analysts and many reporters and many politicians seem to think it's sort of the only a Midwest heartland issue. But manufacturing is much bigger than that. It's national. The California is the biggest manufacturing state in the country. Texas is a major manufacturing state. It's not just Ohio and Indiana and Michigan and Illinois and Iowa and states in our part of the world. We can build, in the case of my state, we can build in our auto industry, which has been a leading economic engine for all kinds of next generation manufacturing. Wall Street Journal had an article a couple of weeks ago tracing the importance of the auto industry along the Ohio Turnpike from Toledo to Cleveland to Akron to Youngstown. And the story wasn't the auto industry itself, but it was all the companies that grew out of auto entrepreneurship, of auto technology, of all that the auto industry did. Companies as diverse as jobs in the aerospace industry, even the soap industry, a major soap manufacturer makes Purell. You know, that company Gojo came out of the tire industry, which, you know, was obviously related to the auto industry in Akron. Those jobs were created out of American manufacturing's ingenuity and entrepreneurship. Plain and simple, as we work to build more fuel-efficient autos, we'll expand opportunities for new manufacturing jobs that become part of the green jobs supply chain. We'll literally grow our economy as we protect our environment. Just a sampling of the scale of opportunity. Every commercial scale wind turbine built uses the equivalent amount of steel as 225 mid-size cars. Every time you turn on a light bulb powered by solar panels, you use enough glass to replace your car windshield. If every home were insulated at current Energy Department recommended levels, we'd need an additional 34 million tons of insulation, and that means jobs, and we would save nearly $13 billion a year in energy costs. As Mark said, I have conducted about 125 roundtables around Ohio. We'll invite 20 or so people from a community, good cross-section of people, and just ask them questions about what we can do in partnership with local government, with local business, with local labor, with local community service organizations. One of the things that's come out of this repeatedly is a program with community action organizations called weatherization, where the government hires teams of four people, usually one team per county in counties of 30 to 50 to 60,000, and they will weatherize. This team of four people will go out, spend 3, 4, 5 days at normally the home of an elderly person who's low income, and they will weatherize their home. It creates jobs. It builds skills for these workers. We in the stimulus bill are going to perhaps close to double the amount that we're spending on weatherization through this program. Every place I've gone in my state, people have told me the waiting list is 2 or 3 years for senior citizens low-income senior citizens who need their homes weatherized. And that plays right into Owens Corning in Newark, Ohio. It was the first and the largest home insulation plant in the nation. It's not the first thing that pops into your mind when you think of green jobs, but that's the point. It's an example of the reach and diversity that defines the green energy manufacturing supply chain. Just this morning, I was reading on the way in, the Wall Street Journal, there's a special journal report on energy, How to Go Green in Hard Times, and it's not just going green. They give examples what we do with high-tech thermostats and air filters and compact fluorescent lights. And it's not just people individually save money and companies saving money. It's the number of jobs that it creates by doing the right thing on energy. And I remember growing up when I was first in politics three decades ago, there was always it's either good for the economy or it's good environmental policy, that the environment always costs jobs. And we've obviously grown way beyond that to understand things like this, that good environmental policy, good energy policy obviously creates jobs. And it creates jobs in a lot of sectors, but it particularly in manufacturing, which is woven into the fabric of our nation for good reason. We let our country's manufacturing capability erode at our own peril. Manufacturing for many Americans, perhaps for most Americans in our history, in our recent history, in our last 50 or 75 years, has been the ticket to the middle class. Manufacturing jobs pay better than other jobs, have a stronger multiplying effect, supporting as many as 5 other jobs, and are critical in helping support the vital public services in schools and communities across the nation. And only manufacturing can build the new green energy technologies that can halt climate change and our dependence on foreign oil and help to keep us globally competitive. How do we do that? We first, as President Duenstadt suggested, we pass a climate change bill that puts a price on carbon that will drive demand for green energy. By creating markets for green energy, we can stabilize our nation's energy supply, reduce our greenhouse gases, and bolster manufacturing. It's been estimated in terms of a global market, the advance in energy sector will double several times over the next decade, from $55 billion to $225 billion. Wind power alone will grow from $18 billion to a $61 billion market. And if we do not establish a significant green energy manufacturing component in our nation, as part of our larger climate change efforts, we'll end up exchanging dependence on foreign oil for dependence on foreign solar manufacturing. That's no plan for success. Oberlin College, one of the great small colleges in our country, is about 15 minutes from where I live. Oberlin College is the home, built about 5 years ago, of the largest building, fully powered solar energy building. Many of you are nodding. Thank you for knowing that. On any college campus in the nation, even larger than any building in Arizona. If I could add there, maybe that's not still true after five.
Not
but
still true.
Oh, it's not still, is that true? It's not still true.
Not
okay.
Still true.
I won't tell that story again, or I won't tell. At least I won't tell with a guy from Arizona in the audience.
We just installed 10 okay. megawatts okay. of solar so on our campus.
Nonetheless. But more to the point, there is a point to this, that at Oberlin, I did ask, at Oberlin College, when I talked to the gentleman building this and the architect, they had to buy all their solar panels in Germany and Japan. No surprise there. Putting a price on carbon to create green energy demand is crucial, but it's not enough. We don't have the luxury to rely on one winning strategy, as you can see in this report. We need to pursue all of them. We must make a major investment in green energy research and development so we can achieve these breakthroughs. And that is why this report and the discussion it starts is so important to all of us and to our country right now. Our nation's system of energy production delivery is unsustainable. Our dependence on fossil fuel threatens our economy, threatens our national security, and threatens our grandchildren's earth, as you know. The global economy is relying on fossil fuels for 85% of its energy needs. And by 2030, global energy needs are expected to grow by 50% over 2005 levels. Existing technologies are, of course, simply inadequate to meet those sustainability goals. Investments in new green energy technologies are the only path towards economic and environmental sustainability. Green energy technology must be researched here, and that research must be translated and commercialized into jobs where we build green energy here. And I would close as I was thinking, listening to the president speak. It occurred to me what we are able to do in this country and what we've done in the past. When I saw the picture of Senator Justin Morrill of Vermont, who was whose brainchild was the land grant universities of which some are represented here today. I thought about when the federal government makes a major commitment to a national effort. And you can go back as early as the Erie Canal, when the U.S. government made a major commitment to build the Erie Canal and the other canal systems, and what that did to spawn all kinds of economic growth, all kinds of technology, all kinds of advancement in the sciences and in our economy. And then you can look at what happened with the land grants. You can look at what happened when the government made its commitment with President Eisenhower and Senator Albert Gore Sr. On the interstate highway system in the 1950s, and the government's commitment on technology and computers in the 70s and 80s. And then you figure what happens when the government makes a major commitment and puts some of the brightest people in the country together, like the people represented in this room, people that have an understanding of the public sector, have an understanding of science and technology, have an understanding of how to work to translate that research and commitment into the private sector. And you can look at the kind of growth, and you can look at the ways that our country has so well met those challenges. That's why your work is so important. That's why we can't stop. That's why the real work for all of us starts now. Thank you.
Well, thank you for those really thoughtful remarks, Senator Brown. You indeed provided us some important perspectives about the issues, but also the opportunities before us. And we'll wish you well now as you get back to saving the U.S. economy with the recovery package. So with that, we now do have a good 15 or 20 minutes for some questions of our three presidents here. So why don't we go now to some questions from the audience, with the usual urging that you limit speeches and ask concise questions. I think we have capable Brookings staffers brandishing mics for you. Let's take the questions actually three at a time, and please preface your question with your name and your affiliation. Here, sure. Yellow shirt. Yeah. So we'll take three.
Hi, my name is, is this on? Okay. Hi, my name is Seth Katz, and I'm just here as a concerned citizen. My question about these institutes, and I think they're a great idea, is how do we distinguish between basic science research, which is already funded, and energy research? Because it seems like in many cases there will be an overlap. How do we sort of make sure that both of those are funded, that this doesn't just supplant basic science funding?
Good. Okay. How about a couple more? Good. Right here.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim. I run something called the Energy Conversation and also the Energy Consensus, which we started back in 2005 and managed to get into the President's State of the Union speech, "The Nation is Addicted to Oil." I think you've left something out. My own view is that energy, though technology is really important, the really important thing is how people think, feel, and behave. I grew up as a Bell Labs baby. My father had over 100 patents there. I know what that was like, and he got rewarded for doing good work. He got a dollar for each patent. We have this problem now where the value system in our country is about how much money you make. And what worries me is the intellectual property issues that are likely to come out of what you're talking about. And until we can change our value system, which says the commons is more important than what I get, I don't see how we're going to get there. Because I do think the technology is going to be abundant, but it really is about people.
Okay, thank you. And maybe one more. Let's see. How about over here?
David Doty from Doty Scientific. We have heard and can all understand that the DOE has not done an adequate job of fostering innovation. I worry that the institutes that you describe may fall in the same trap, that they publish extremely narrow solicitations, outside-the-box ideas that may be scientifically sound and even really breakthroughs, often are not supported. Is there that same risk with these fairly narrowly described institutes?
Okay, very good. Maybe, Jim, do you want to take on distinguishing powerful and viable propositions from other ones? I think the first question.
Sure. Yep.
you know, there are various flavors of research. There's some that's driven by curiosity, by the interest of science, that wins Nobel Prizes and so forth. There's some that's driven by technical applications, by a certain objective. That's sometimes called Jeffersonian research because although Jefferson portrayed the purpose of the Lewis and Clark expedition as fundamental curiosity-driven research, actually he was trying to not to get the Spanish too upset while he explored the American West for eventual colonization. I think what we have here is a situation where the knowledge base that's necessary for taking fundamental discovery out of the laboratory and into the marketplace where it serves society is simply not there. It does require a certain amount of long-term research. That's in fact what's missing. It used to be done by places like Bell Labs and General Motors Research Labs and so forth. It's just not done anymore by industry. The labs do it, but consistent with their mission. And what we're talking about are new structures that really have that as their most fundamental purpose. They will do some degree of fundamental research, but it's use-inspired. It has a certain application associated with it. And that's I think, the theme of these.
Great. Dr. Gee, do you want to take on the moral issue here and the question of people's behavior?
First of all, let me just say that I do believe that Oberlin still has the largest. I think,
but they don't have any sunshine.
But you know, what my senator says is true. Is true. I just want to be on the record, Michael. And I hope you'll tell him that I said that after he's left.
I'm meeting with Senator McCain later, and I agree with everything.
Yeah, you've got a problem. But anyway, I think that I would say that first of all, I agree absolutely. The issue I think that the three of us are trying to talk about is not about doing the same business in the same way, and it's really about a word that I think we'd all agree with. It's about reinvention. It's maybe even about reformation or revolution, and that has to do with creating different kinds of structures that will not only create a culture of collaboration, but also that we will collaborate with many different partners, including our publics. Because you're absolutely right. If we continue to reward people in the same way, if we continue to have the same kind of reward structures, but yet we're talking about trying to create something revolutionary within that, we will fail. But the moral imperative drives us because we realize that we are now facing a cliff and we're going to fall all off. We're all going to fall off that. But if we can change the moral imperative by changing the structures themselves, by moving from these very, I don't want to quote myself, but I will. I talked yesterday about the fact that universities are organized very vertically, and what we've got to do is we've got to organize ourselves horizontally. And this is the same kind of thinking. We're moving from a different paradigm. And if we do that, then we do change moral behavior. We do change personal behavior. And that, I think, is what we're trying to accomplish.
Very good. Dr. Crow, what about the narrowness question, the question of sort of repeating the same in a new context?
Yeah, so to Mr. Doty's question, if that's the most likely trap that we would fall in, which would be to replicate what we already have, which I already indicated at the opening of my comments, if we have that and just put more money into it, we will fail. And so it means that these institutes, and I think the way that they're described under various types, various structures, various mechanisms, and with this regional focus, work in ways to try to avoid following the same structural path. It is, as Ms. Wertheim suggested, often about behavior, not only the behavior of the citizens, but the behavior of the scientists, the researchers, their drivers, their motivators, and so forth. And so if we find ways to change the metrics from the metrics of scientific output to the metrics of a certain kind of outcome for a region, then we're looking at behavior, then we're looking at different types of scientific activity, then we're looking at different ways to measure our success. And if we stick to that and we change our mindsets, we'll have a better chance of not falling into that sort of structural mechanism that we have right now that you're worried about.
Very good. How about three more questions? Let's go way over to the left. Politically or... or otherwise.
I'm Adam Rosenberg with the House Science and Technology Committee. I think that there is broad consensus that we need far more resources for energy research and development throughout the federal government. The big question I have is, the recommendation is that this builds up to $6 billion roughly for EDIIs, when that's roughly equal to the current amount that we spend on energy R&D. And within that, you have $100 million to $200 million for each EDII. How does this not become another, or essentially become a network of permanent earmarks, which you might say current large laboratories and other institutions are? And how does this compare to the Energy Frontier Research Centers, which aren't permanent earmarks, but the Department of Energy Office of Science has recently proposed and has a lot more targeted focus on specific areas with a lot of research behind them?
Good question. Now let's vacillate over to the right. How about back here?
Hi, I'm Angeline with a local nonprofit called RTASK. And my concern is kind of general overall sustainability. And I worry that if we focus too much on solving the climate crisis without thinking about overall sustainability, we'll kind of end up in our same position with other external problems, kind of like biofuels ended up leading us into a food crisis. So something like that. In this proposal, is there any kind of consideration of how we'll integrate studies of sustainability and make that an important part of this thing?
Very good.
Yes.
And how about back to the middle here? Yes.
Hi. The efforts you're talking about, which are very important, all tend to centralize. But in terms of getting adequate, true innovation, don't we need to increase our funding for investigator-initiated grants to spread it around?
Okay. Let's, Jim, why don't we, how do we avoid this becoming a system of energy discovery earmarks?
Let me talk a little bit about scale. The energy sector of our economy is about $1.4 trillion a year. We spend about $400 billion a year in imported oil. We spend about $150 billion a year on federal R&D, about $30 billion on biomedical research, and a significant fraction of that goes to the campuses. We're recommending a similar kind of an investment, $25 to $30 billion a year, most of which will flow into the existing energy research activities, the national labs and industry. And so within that range, $5 to $6 billion a year for this kind of an activity is not that large a scale. It's very comparable to biomedical research. In fact, it's less than that. It's when you add in state support and so forth, that's kind of comparable to what agricultural research has been for a long time. It's very large if you try to take $6 billion out of the $3.4 billion a year you're now spending on energy R&D. Okay? And that's the problem. Okay? It's The simple fact of the matter is, for a variety of reasons, whether you're a conspiracy theorist or whether you just think it's been my neglect, we have throttled back in both the public and private sector the necessary investment in the new kinds of knowledge and technologies we're going to need to lick the energy challenges faced by this country. And we've got to step back up to the plate and begin to reinvest. Okay, where do we get the money? Well, we're talking now in the trillions, right? In terms of the economic stimulus package. But in reality, we're talking with numbers much larger than that in our existing subsidy, not in R&D, but simply of the energy sector. When you talk about cap and trade or ways to control carbon emissions, you're talking perhaps in the hundreds of billions. So the money is there, the resources are there. What is absent is the will and the recognition that this is one of the great challenges today faced by our society. Will these become entrenched? Well, the energy frontier or frontier energy R&D centers are really nothing more than the engineering research centers, the science and technology centers that the National Science Foundation has been running for many years at the same size. Just the fact the Department of Energy never has gotten into that game. They're finally being lured into it. They're going to build some of these things. The National Science Foundation has been managing dozens of these things around the country. They put sunsets on them. so that after 10 years they fade away. They're rigorously evaluated. We think the Energy Discovery Innovation Institutes would also be determined through some kind of a peer competition. They would have very strong kinds of evaluation, not simply for scientific merit, but what their real impact is on regional activities at regular intervals. And we would probably recommend that they have sunsets put on them so they don't become a permanent entitlement. So all of the issues you raise are certainly appropriate things to raise, but they're a part and parcel of how we do research in this country and have done it for many, many years. And I think agencies like the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, have extensive experience in managing these kinds of activities at the scale are larger than the ones we're talking about today.
Dr. Kroll, why don't you take on the question of whether we're missing the point and missing some overarching sustainability across sectors and across industries?
Well, Angeline's question was actually very good, because it is something that we commonly do, and that is that we limit our thinking to these small boxes. And so we say, well, let's do biofuels and build switchgrass options and corn, and lo and behold, the price of tortillas in Mexico changes, and the social and cultural infrastructure around the world begins to be affected by a whole range of things. And so the thing that we have to do goes back to what I talk about as mindset. We've got to stop being cavemen and cavewomen. They're people that have very limited thinking. They think only about the isolated part of the problem. We need new tools. There's a new tool being developed out of an NSF center right now called Real-Time Technology Assessment. It tries to look at all of the areas of implication, social, cultural, economic, technological, behavioral, across all dimensions of a technology as it moves forward. And I think that we need to make certain that we don't do what we did in the past, which is try to pick a technological pathway. And no matter what happens with that pathway, that's what we do. And then we end up finding out later that yes, we created all this energy. At the same time, we can't deal with the nuclear waste, and we've doomed the Columbia River. And so we have to think through these things at the time that we advance these technologies, not later. And so that's a very, very good question. And these institutes would be very equipped to be able to do that, in my view.
Can I respond to the last question just a moment?
Absolutely.
There's no question that to be successful in this, you have to provide sustained support for the brightest minds in the country to get them to focus on these issues. That will take sustained, significant support over a very long period of time of faculty, of other researchers that work in the kind of traditional mode of a faculty member, a laboratory, graduate students, and so forth. There are many models on how this can be done effectively. I think one of the most effective ones is the Howard Hughes Medical Investigators, which support eminent scientists over a long, sustained period of time, so they don't have to worry so much about grantsmanship, and has enormous impact. Some of the members of the transition team that have been looking at energy and innovation issues believe that same paradigm, what do they call it, the National Energy Initiative or something like that, should be a model that's adopted in this. It's perfectly compatible with what we're talking about in this so-called hub and spoke system, where these groups, faculty with very long-term support, probably on the campuses rather than these institutes, would be supported, whether they're supported directly channeled or through the institutes, but they would be coordinated both among themselves and with other people doing the more applied stuff. But I couldn't agree more that in all of this, we have to sustain and, in fact, increase the support of getting the best people to begin to address this problem. And it's going to take those kinds of very senior kinds of appointments and research grants to make it happen.
Let's just take two more questions. How about here by the aisle?
Bob Grove from the Arizona Office of Market.
Hi, Bob.
How do you do? We go way back. This is a question for just you. You're talking about the brightest minds, and global. Why not go global? Bring them here. They already have in Arizona First Solar, but they do manufacturing in Malaysia. So, and then light emitting diodes, energy conservation. These are global issues in the optics community that can save and do a lot of good.
Good question. And how about here again, a centrist?
Thank you. Chris Ajemian. I'm a consultant who has worked for National Laboratory. And my question to the president is, sounds like this is an excellent initiative, but is it going to be housed within the Department of Energy, which, in my view, is an organization that doesn't really seem to know what its mission is? We could debate whether we have a national energy policy or whether we should, but it seems like DOE has several masters. And sometimes it feels like DOE is, its main goal is really to be tech support to other agencies. And so if we're going to do science, we're going to do energy or outcome-related energy policy in DOE, does that mean that it's going to be its own master? Thank you.
Okay, two good questions. How about, Dr. Gee, do you want to talk about how this should intersect with, you know, global innovation?
Let me try to, there are so many questions that are floating around here. Let me try to draw just a general analogy if I can. The answer is yes, it should. But let me try to put a little bit more in context. I think that Jim and Michael and I, when we took on this project and agreed to do it because we do not believe that we can put old wine into new bottles. Rather, what we have to do is we have to put new wine into new bottles. In other words, we believe totally in a recreation, in a new way of thinking about these issues. And so when you ask these questions whether the Department of Energy is set up to do this, I think that what we are talking about is a fundamental recasting of the way that we really do our business. It starts with our own universities. Michael has done remarkable things about at Arizona State. We're trying to do that at at Ohio State, and certainly the University of Michigan has been doing that. And so, to answer your questions, absolutely, the world is flat. We're going to have to connect ourselves, and if we don't, then we will certainly become an isolated island, and we'll become a third world country very quickly. And as to the Department of Energy, the same, we would ask the same question as we think about anew in terms of this pattern of real time, real opportunity. We're going to have to ask our government to reinvent government as part of this process. So this is not simply about energy; it's also about a way of thinking.
I think these same two questions should be handled by each of our team here. So Jim, do you want to go, and then Mike?
Sure. Science Today is a global activity. Cyber infrastructure means that I'm interacting in real time with dozens of scientists around the world every day. In fact, I interact 100 times a day with someone in the Brookings Institution. I mean, that's just the way science works. It's now independent of time and place, and most intellectual communities are global in extent. Whether we should attract people to the United States, well, we're always interested in attracting outstanding people to the United States. But on the other hand, we're also interested in working with them to tap their minds and their ideas, and that can be done around the world. So that's just kind of the way things work. To the DOE and the national labs, the national labs are extraordinary resources for this country. They're one of the greatest concentrations of scientific and technical talent that we have. They have enormous creativity. They have the opportunity to do not only fundamental research, but they can do it at immense scale. It would be very difficult to replicate by universities or anyone else. But the problem is that much of that creativity has been difficult to unleash because of the way that Washington constrains the labs because of their history and so forth. I think from our interaction with people in the labs, they also understand that new paradigms are necessary. They have some very creative ideas to approach it. Many of them liked very much the idea of these kind of partnership interacting with regional markets and so forth that are characteristic of the Discovery Innovation Institutes, and that's why we viewed the labs as just as universities, as potential sites where these things could form. But I think the key here is to realize that different paradigms are necessary, and organizations, whether they be research universities or national laboratories or industry, have to have the flexibility to allow creative people to shape the way they do things to adapt to that. I personally have enormous confidence that now as Secretary of Energy, you probably have a person that understands this better than anybody. Someone that understands the frustrations at the time of leading a major national lab, someone that has done Nobel laureate quality work in universities, someone that has actually spun off institutions, kind of similar to what we're talking about with the bioenergy institutions that were formed with the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory and the University of California, Berkeley, and so forth. He gets it. And whether Washington bureaucracy will let him follow through, I don't know. But I think finally we have a person at the helm that may respond to some of these frustrations that many of us have had.
Dr. Crowe, do you want to take one final
Quickly, to my Arizonan Bob from Tucson, fellow Arizonan. The simplest way to deal with this immigration issue associated with scientists and attracting the best talent to the United States is just staple the green card to the back of the diploma. So the issue is we want to attract talent. We want them to prove themselves. The diploma is the proof of their effort and their ability. So you just staple the green card, and then you let things sort of take forward from there. To this question of the Department of Energy, while I agree very much with Jim's comments about Secretary Chu, he's also inherited one of the strangest and most bizarre institutions in the universe. And so in the following sense, it transitioned from the Manhattan Project, which was a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers military project designed to produce a weapon of mass destruction, to the Atomic Energy Commission, which was an effort to continue the development of weapons of mass destruction and maybe on the side do something else with it so that you could continue developing the weapons of mass destruction with a little bit less heat on you. And then there was this this temporary thing, the Energy Research and Development Administration, that existed for a short period of time. And then in 1977, the Department of Energy was founded. Along the way, the mission, the core mission, remains develop the weapons necessary to protect and defend the United States. That still remains at the heart of the core mission. And so one needs to go in, I believe, and seriously adjust, expand, enhance, whatever the word is, the definition of the core mission of the Department of Energy. I think that was the framing of the question. That goes to what I was talking about in terms of the outcome. What is the outcome that the Department of Energy is working toward? Right now, I don't think you can get consensus among the leadership within the department of what that outcome ought to be. There's too many conflicting things in the intellectual history, the legacy of that department.
Maybe the right word, given what you just described, is blow it up.
Oh, no.
Well, with that, we're going to need to move on from this very stimulating period of Q&A and get ready for our panel discussion, which will hopefully be as lively. So essentially now we're going to pivot from framing the energy problem and Brookings's suggestion of one proposed response to some discussion of these ideas from a variety of very specific and relevant perspectives, that of the environmental community, that of the VC world, that of the private sector, that of regional economic development, that of public education. Basically, as you're hearing, we assume that the move to a global clean energy economy is going to require fully engaging the capabilities of the entire American and global innovation system. That means we need to create forums for intense, high-speed, and productive interactions between research universities, units of the DOE lab system, corporate R&D centers, venture capital and entrepreneurship community, regional economic leaders, regional clean tech industry clusters. Given that, we thought it would be valuable to hear the opinions, suggestions, and caveats of an array of such voices, since all these communities are going to be critical to the success of any drive to foment the kind of revolution we need to enter into a low-carbon economy. So I'd like now to invite our panelists to join Bill Bates up here now, and we'll get you mic'd up and ready to go.